What do we need so we can all survive and thrive? Could it be revolutionary love?
Revolutionary love is about loving not just the people that you know, not just the next door neighbor. It is about looking on all human beings on this planet as deserving equally of well-being as you yourself.
That's Rabbi Michael Lerner. We talk with him about his book, Revolutionary Love, A Political Manifesto to Heal and Transform the World. Then we look further at how to build solidarity in our divided nation. We play excerpts from other episodes of Writer's Voice in 2020 that address that issue. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. We live in a country that's deeply divided politically. Many of us feel utterly hopeless that the divide can ever be bridged. Yet it must if we are to deal with the crises we face, from COVID-19 to economic and racial inequality to the climate emergency. Rabbi Michael Lerner says the cause is the capitalist globalization of selfishness. In his book, Revolutionary Love, Lerner says we must replace selfishness with a globalization of generosity, of empathy, and environmental sanity. His strategy is for a new democratic socialism built on love, kindness, and compassion for one another. Rabbi Michael Lerner is the founder of Tikkun, an organization dedicated to the meaning of its name, to repair the world. Rabbi Michael Lerner, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, as you say, it has a fundamentally simple message that rings with intuitive truth. This is a message, this book, Revolutionary Love, I think the message is really in the title, goes deeply to a kind of epiphany I had several years ago when I felt that if we are really going to protect our planet and create another world that's possible, that's just, and nourishes life, that we need to have a kind of moral revolution, a kind of revolutionary spiritual movement. And I felt at the time that nobody was talking about that. You know, everything was always in terms of, you know, economic justice, which was perfectly great. But underneath economic justice and environmental justice is fundamentally the idea that we all have to take care of each other. Is that right?
Absolutely. So I am a strong supporter of economic justice and political justice in this country. But I agree with you that underlying it, we need a new ethos in this country. And that's what this book, Revolutionary Love, is really all about. It's about how to develop that new ethos, that new way of thinking about our world. Unfortunately, we're up against a huge indoctrination that keeps on happening every day in the worlds of work and in the media. And that indoctrination is the ethos of selfishness, of looking out for number one, of believing that nobody else in the world is going to take care of you, so you've got to take care of yourself and put yourself above everybody else because there's no other way, because everybody else is doing that. And because everybody else is doing that, it seems impractical and even utopian to think that we could live in a different kind of society. And yet, what I try to do in Revolutionary Love is show that it's not only not utopian, it is actually the absolute necessity for being able to then turn to the serious problems of our society, the most serious one being the destruction of the environment, and deal with it in a serious and holistic way that isn't constrained by our sense of, well, it'll never happen. We can't really change the way that we've organized our society. So let's keep going into the inevitable environmental disaster that we are facing today, of which the pandemic is merely first one of many plagues that will get worse and worse.
So you've been talking about revolutionary love in general terms. Could you get a little more specific?
First of all, about revolutionary love, it is the kind of love that is enjoined by the Bible. The Bible has, of course, that famous, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But that appears once in the Torah. But about 37 other times, there's an injunction or varieties of the following. When you come into your land, do not oppress the stranger, the other. The Hebrew word is ger, and it means the other or the stranger. Remember that you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So we could say the same thing about the United States. Remember, your ancestors in this country were strangers here. They were the immigrants. They were the newcomers here. And we need a society that treats every newcomer and every person as equally valuable. So revolutionary love is about loving not just the people that you know, not just the next door neighbor. It is about looking on all human beings on this planet as deserving equally of well-being as you yourself. And that's a high bar, but it's a bar that actually many people already embody in parts of their life. When somebody says, oh, well, that's against human nature to risk anything for the sake of somebody else, I often point to the incredible reality of 9/11, in which after that horrendous attack on the towers, thousands of people came down to there and tried their best to save the lives of people. And that involved thousands of them going into those burning buildings and helping people get out of there. And hundreds of them actually died in that process. That is, they were willing to sacrifice, to risk the sacrifice, to risk their lives for the sake of others. That's revolutionary love, recognizing that we're all in this together and that the love of the other is precisely what will rebound to you and make your life better when you're living in a society where people are really caring for each other. So that's the central vision of revolutionary love. And it's one that requires us to reject the message of the capitalist marketplace with its notion that the rational way to live is to maximize your own good without regard to the well-being of others. That's the ethos of selfishness. And the United States is one of the most selfish countries on the planet. It has generated so much in the way of shutting our eyes to the suffering of others that we ourselves cause. In fact, not only to others in other countries, but in our own country, shutting our eyes to the suffering of the homeless, shutting our eyes to the suffering of those who are desperate to flee countries that have been oppressive to them or violent towards them and get refuge here. That's what the United States used to be in the old days, but we've moved far away from that today. So that's part of what it means to embrace revolutionary love. But more concretely, we suggest as a functional definition that we need a new bottom line. Today, every economic institution, our corporations, our government policies, our healthcare system, our educational system, our cultural systems, our legal systems, they're all based on the old bottom line that judges those institutions to be efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize money or power for somebody. Today, the new bottom line challenges that. And it says, we want every institution that I've just mentioned, including our legal system, including our political system, including our economy, including our cultural systems, including our educational systems, to be judged efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize people's capacity to be loving and caring, kind and generous, ethically and environmentally sensitive and responsible for protecting the earth, maximize our commitment to social and economic justice and maximize our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, rather than seeing them solely through the framework of what can they do for me to advance my interests, and looking at the earth, not simply from the standpoint of, I wonder if there's something here I can turn into a product and sell, a commodity that I can sell in the marketplace and make a buck off the earth, but rather also looking at the earth from the standpoint of awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur and mystery of this universe. That's the new bottom line. And if we can get that new bottom line adopted by more and more people, we will be a long way towards creating the caring society.
That's really beautifully put. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rabbi Michael Lerner about his wonderful new manifesto. It's called Revolutionary Love. You know, you mentioned before that we have a selfish culture, and I think a lot of people, you know, you hear it a lot on the right, that there is an equation between being selfish and being free, having freedom. Yet you point out that there is a profound, what do you call it, the great deprivation here, a profound psychological as well as spiritual crisis in America. So does selfishness mean that we're free or quite the opposite?
You're right. It certainly doesn't mean we're free. It means that we're tied to a very narrow definition of self-interest that ends up being deeply unsatisfying for most people in the country, and hence tremendous amount of pain in this country. So I'm not only a rabbi, but I'm also a psychologist. And I was the principal investigator of one of the largest studies ever funded by the NIMH with regard to the psychodynamics of work and family life. In that, as the principal investigator, and I had a bunch of associates working with me, we had groups and interviews with thousands of middle-income working people. And it took a while for people to reveal this, but in those groups, eventually, because you ask people how they're doing and they say fine, but that's because people want to be seen as successful and doing okay in the society. But when you stick around with them in groups for a little bit longer time, eventually you can give people the capacity to talk about what's really hurting them in their lives. And what we found was that almost everybody is carrying around a self-blaming story. Now, why a self-blaming story? Because they've grown up in a society which tells them that anybody can make it if you really try. And this is a meritocracy. And so wherever you end up in the society, you created your reality yourself, and you have nobody to blame but yourself. Of course, what this leaves out is the whole economic and political structures within which we live our lives. But the internalization of that message leads the top 10 to 15 to maybe even 20% of economic survivors, the ones who are at the top of the economic ladder, say, yeah, great. Yes, I did it. I made myself, I got here and I worked hard and so forth. But for the other 80% of the population, those of us who are making less than, let's say, $70,000 a year, for the other 80% of the population, this message is internalized as self-blaming. Oh, I have struggles financially. I'm scared about what's going to happen in my life because I don't have financial reserves, because I'm not in the upper groups. I have jobs that aren't really that fulfilling. I can't see the connection between what I'm doing and some higher purpose for my life. So I have nobody to blame but myself. I screwed up. Now, the truth of the matter is that this is a society with a pretty rigid class structure. And although there's a limited mobility in any part of the economy, from the poorest to the most successful financially, it's very limited. It's about 1% to 2% that can move in that direction over the course of many, many years. But the vast majority of people are going to find very, very little in the way of mobility from where they are to where they might want to be. And what we discovered is that it's a total lie to say that you're in that lower 80% of income earners or wealth holders because you didn't work hard enough. On the contrary, if you look at the bottom 20 to 30% of the population, they work just as hard, if not a lot harder, than anybody in the top 20%. And they have the same range of IQ as anybody in the top 20% of the earners and wealth holders. Where you are is not a function of your smarts, and it's not a function of how hard you worked. It's a function of often of what you were born into and what miraculous things opened up for you. Now, yeah, there are some people who have made it up, and they are brought out and presented to us as, look, here's this African-American who's now on the Supreme Court or in the Senate. Here's this immigrant who came from an immigrant family, and they are successful here. So there are such people. They're presented to us as though this was the reality, whereas actually it's an extremely unrepresentative reality, and most people are not in there, and it's not their fault. There's a class structure here and an economic and political structure that makes it very, very difficult. Now, on top of that, because the daily experience in the world of work is one that makes you feel like you're surrounded by people who are looking out for number one, you come out of the work world. And by the way, we ask people, how do you feel about your work world? And they would say, it's lousy. I don't like this job. I don't like what I'm doing. So we'd say, okay, then why not change this system? And they'd say, well, I can't do that because everybody else is so selfish and looking out for number one that they'll never move. So we've said to them then, how did you know that? And say, well, that's what everybody says in the world of work. And that's how the whole world of work is structured. And yes, but the thing is that everybody is saying this about everybody else. So we'd come back and say, okay, let's talk about your friends. Pick your top 10 friends. Are they all selfish? And after thinking about it, they'd say, 9 out of 10 would say, no, they're not. It's just everyone else is selfish. In other words, people have come to believe this almost as a matter of faith because it is represented to them in the world of work that this is natural. And then they turn on the television and almost every sitcom is about somebody having power over somebody else, whether it's in economic terms or whether it's in political terms or whether it's in sexual conquest, whatever it is, it's all about who is top dog and who isn't, who's going to get more power over others and who's going to have less power. So over and over again, and this, by the way, this happens starting in childhood, not only from our parents who tell us, hey, you could become president of the United States if you work hard. And then the school system that is based on that, hey, if you study enough and you work hard here in this, you'll get any job you want. Not true. There are only a limited number of jobs that give people any opportunity to really use their intelligence and creativity. So when they get into the world, they already bring this with them, and they've come to believe that the only rational way to live is to advance their own interests without regard to the consequences for others. But this is a disaster, because that way, when you hold that belief, inevitably, you bring that into your family life. And pretty soon, families feel very insecure, because now, increasingly, people enter into marriages based on the notion that, oh, well, this person is going to satisfy more of my needs than anybody else. Now, what's the problem there? I'm not putting anybody down who thinks that way. I'm merely saying that when you have a society filled like that, more and more people find at some point in their life that their partner has encountered somebody whom they believe might satisfy yet more of their needs. So if the bottom line is maximizing your own self-interest, then you'd be irrational to stay in a relationship if there's another one that you could be in that would satisfy more of your needs. So as a result, you live in a society with someplace between 45 and 50% of marriages ending up in divorce. But it's not just those that end up in divorce, because most everybody, even those who don't end up in divorce, never are sure that their partner won't at some point in their life go for their own narrow self-interest without regard to the commitment to the other. So that makes everybody feel deeply insecure. Now, on top of that, you then have a deep hole in the heart of most people, because actually, most people want a world of work and a life in which somehow or other, they are connecting to higher meaning and purpose for their life. Right now, the capitalist marketplace teaches them that the highest goal that you can have is to become more financially successful. But first of all, that's out of the question for about 80% of the population. And secondly, even for those who do make it there, they soon find out that having that money is not enough, that they need something else, higher meaning and purpose to their life that isn't judged by how much money they have or how much power they have, but by connecting to some higher meaning for their life. And that's where religion comes in, or other forms of spirituality, and gives them a path to something that will give them real meaning and purpose. Now, the tragedy in American society is that many of those religious institutions are connected to reactionary politics. So you go into those institutions, and many of the people, at least in the right-wing churches, they embrace you and they welcome you. And they help with a major problem that leads so many people to alcoholism or drug abuse or other self-destructive paths for their life. The message that is given by the capitalist marketplace, as I said, is it's your own fault. And that makes so many people feel terrible about themselves that they turn to alcohol, they turn to drugs, they turn to a variety of behaviors that manage to momentarily drown the pain that they have when they ever confront the alleged truth that they've screwed up their own life. But it's not true. What's true is that you're living in a class-dominated society and a patriarchal society in which is structured to reward the few at the expense of the many. But in any event, they go to these churches and the churches say, you know, you shouldn't blame yourself. It's not your fault. And that is so strong a message that many of those people who go there feel like, this is what I was waiting for, a place where people could accept me and say that I'm not to blame for not being more successful in the society. But then the right-wing churches take another step and they say, the reason why it's not your fault is because it is the fault of, and this is a universal formula, that then they go to whoever is the demeaned other of their society and say, it's their fault that you're not having a fulfilling life. It's not your fault. It's these other people's fault. Well, in Europe, in the first half of the 20th century, who was that? That was the Jews. The Jews were blamed for everybody else's not having fulfillment in their work and fulfillment in their life. In the United States, it has always been Native Americans and African Americans who get blamed. But in the past 50 years, that has expanded dramatically, so that now it also includes feminists, all people of color, refugees, liberals, progressives. It's endlessly expanding. You can add others to that, gays and lesbians, right? And so many other groups are the fault. They're only looking out for their own interests, whereas we in this church, we care about everybody's interests. Well, so, for a lot of people, particularly white people, that's such an important message that makes them feel they want to stay there. Sadly, we have a left in this country that doesn't understand how important it is to address this hunger for meaning and purpose to their lives.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Rabbi Michael Lerner about his manifesto, Revolutionary Love. You know, this is very relevant now. We just had an election where, yes, Joe Biden won, but 73 million people voted for Donald Trump. And there are many of us, you know, after the 2016 election, there was a lot of talk about the white working class, basically the Obama to Trump voters. These are people who voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump. And I think Trump's base has only grown in the interim. You have a discussion about what is the left missing? What are we doing wrong? And how should we even talk to people who are Trump voters? And you do something important there, which is you make a few distinctions among that group. Because I know a whole lot of people who just throw their hands up and say, there's no talking to any of them.
Right. Well, there's a percentage, I think a relatively big percentage of Trump voters who really are deeply into racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, anti-Semitism. But there are millions and millions of Trump voters who are not that. And there are a lot of people who, as you say, they voted for Obama. He was an African-American. I mean, the racism wasn't that deep. They'd rather have him than the white man who was running against him. So the conclusion that they're all racist, sexist, homophobes, xenophobes, anti-Semites, et cetera, is not accurate. But the left has done a huge amount to alienate others who could have been on our side, who either ended up not voting at all, even in this last election with highest levels of voting in the presidential election for a very long time. And nevertheless, there were millions of voters who did not vote, and even more so in 2016. So it's those people who could be reached if there was a different kind of left. Now, different in what way? Well, the first thing is, if you listen to the discourse in the past 4 years in liberal circles, let's say the 80 some million people who were supportive of Joe Biden in this election, a lot of them, when asked, well, why did Trump win in 2016, say, oh, that's because they're racist, sexist, homophobes, xenophobes, Islamophobes, anti-Semites, or they're stupid. Well, this message isn't just heard by the people who are in the liberal and progressive world. It is heard by lots and lots of other people. It was amplified when Hillary Clinton said 2 months before the 2016 election, half of those voters are a bundle of deplorables. And I can tell you, because we did research on this, speaking to people who were going door to door in states that could have shifted to being Hillary voters, but they ended up being Trump voters. And people would say to us, to the people that were doing this work, you know, when I asked them why they were thinking of voting for Trump, they would say, well, I haven't made up my mind yet, but I can tell you this, I'm not a deplorable. In other words, they hear what we're saying. They hear it. And when they hear us saying, oh, they're just stupid, this hooks into the self-blaming that they've had all their life about why they haven't been more successful. The mainstream message of the media and of the world of work is, you could be anybody if you were smarter, but you failed because you're not smart enough or because you didn't work hard enough. So when we turn around and start saying, you're stupid, that's why you voted the way you do, it reinforces that terrible feeling about themselves. So they jump to a community where they're welcomed, where they're treated as though they are valuable rather than put down. Now, in the last 4 years, that got even worse because a section of the liberal and progressive world started to talk about all white people as having privilege and all men as being sexist. And that discourse leads many people to feel like, wait a second, you don't know anything about my life. You're telling me just because I have white skin that I have all kinds of privilege? Well, if you came into my world where I have to take two jobs in order to put enough food on the table for my family, or if you came into my world where I am absolutely cannot find a job, or I'm struggling desperately, or if you came into my world and saw how filled it is with people who are taking drugs or alcohol addicted or in other ways, you wouldn't say this is a great privilege.
No, that's true. Let me ask you this, because this is difficult. And let's say for one thing, you know, a whole lot of white people have been waking up in a very sincere way to white skin privilege. But on the one hand, yes, it's easy for people to say, well, I'm not privileged, because they're not in the sense that you're talking about. And yet it is also important for people to understand that the white skin does confer some privilege, because so much in this culture of the things that you're talking about. It's capitalism that was rooted in slavery. And I know from reading your book and from the history of your life that you are passionately in favor of a fundamental ending of racism in this country. So how do we end racism among white people, as well as honoring the ways in which they themselves are suffering in the society?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And the truth is, you will not end racism by calling all whites racist. Even if there's some way in which you could look at the world and say, yes, they have privileges, their privileges are offset by the very intense ways the current unfair distribution of wealth and power in this society disempowers them and makes them feel bad about themselves. So you don't get them to move by making them feel more bad about themselves. Instead, what you do is you develop programs. On the one hand, you develop programs that would benefit them and that they can only get by overcoming whatever part of their privilege they have. Our program, for example, to have education be free, including college education, to have universal health care, to have a society that is based on love and caring, you can have that, but you have to overcome what you think are the benefits of being white. But you don't have to say, hey, you have white skin privilege. That just makes people say, I don't care what else you say, I know about my life and it doesn't feel privileged at all. You don't care about my life. So screw you. I'm going to vote for Trump or whoever is the next fascist that the Republicans are going to put up after the next 4 years in which they do everything possible in the Senate to make it impossible for any part of Joe Biden's programs to get passed through the Congress. So even if it's true, but actually, what's the privilege? The privilege is that you don't get shot where people in color do get shot by police. That's not a great privilege. That's a fundamental right. It's like saying everybody in America is privileged in comparison to people living in countries in South and Central America where people are starving to death. Okay, am I supposed to feel privileged as a result of the fact that I'm not starving to death where people in other countries are starving to death? No. It's not a privilege. It's something that should happen for everybody. So instead of blaming me and saying, you've got American skin privilege, okay, which includes everybody here versus some of the other countries of the world, you say, look, there's a part of you that would like to live in a caring world. And in order to get there, don't compare yourself with the people who have less than you. Compare yourself with the people who have more than you. Because you could be equally successful as everybody else if we change the way the society is arranged. So don't make all men feel guilty. Don't make all white people feel guilty, because that's a sure strategy to guarantee the success of right wingers who will not only not eliminate those distinctions, but will also take more and more and more away from the needs of working people.
How does one talk to people in a way that opens up pathways of caring for
us? Yes, and that's part of what we do in our movement, the Network of Spiritual Progressives, which, by the way, you can find online at spiritualprogressives.org. We have there a training for people to learn what we call prophetic empathy. Now, empathy is being able to put yourself in the place of other people, understanding their feelings and how they understand the world. And that's part of what is needed. We need a liberal and progressive world that can feel empathy for its people who are not yet with us. But we don't even have that embodied in the people who are with us. In fact, if you go to most of the liberal or progressive movements, you'll find very often that there is no place ever in their meetings for people to just sit with each other and get to know each other. There's no message that's given out of, hey, part of what we're about is caring for each other. So let's learn a little bit about each other and how we can make our movement a more loving movement. On the contrary, the people who have left, and there are many of those whom we interviewed, would say, you know, I'd go to these liberal or progressive movement meetings, and all I heard was people arguing with each other, often very disrespectfully. And there was no love there. There was no kindness there. Yes, their objective policies were good policies, but the way they treated each other was awful. I don't want to be part of that. I want to be part of something where people actually treat each other with respect and caring. So the prophetic empathy training that we do, we train people both to be able to recognize the feeling and needs of other people, but simultaneously to also recognize, help them understand that the pain that they feel is not a product of their failures. It's a product of a society based on selfishness and materialism and looking out for number one. And we contrast that with the caring society, caring for each other and caring for the earth. That's what we need, and that's what we can bring to people, a sense of a new possibility of building a different kind of world.
Well, Michael Lerner, the book is Revolutionary Love. It's a beautifully written book, and it's really inspiring, and we've just touched the surface. So thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I appreciate it very much.
Rabbi Lerner is the founder of Tikkun, an interfaith and secular organization dedicated to healing the world. Go to writersvoice.net for links to Tikkun and to find out more about its movement for love and justice. You can also find out more about Michael Lerner's book, Revolutionary Love. Next up, we listen back to some other conversations we had this year about how to build solidarity for a more just and healthy world. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book excerpts and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or on Twitter at Writer's Voice. So, how can we build social solidarity to tackle the society-wide and planet-wide problems we face in such a divided nation? Should the fight against racism take precedence in the movement for social justice, or should the fight against class exploitation be the starting place? It's a point of controversy on the left, as was alluded to by Rabbi Michael Lerner in our first segment. Earlier this year, I asked anti-racism activist Tim Wise about this controversy when I interviewed him about his book, Dispatches from the Race War.
And the question is, how do we build solidarity? I think the biggest mistake that the traditional class-focused left, or what we could call neo-Marxist left, makes, the white Marxist left, is the assumption that if we can just point out people's, you know, economic interests and raise that class consciousness, that suddenly white working people will sort of naturally gravitate to a more progressive politic. There is literally nothing in the history of this country to suggest that that will work for a significant period of time. The reason is precisely this notion of caste that Isabel Wilkerson in her new book by that name points out so clearly is really what we have in this society. We have a society that is given to people called white a symbolic reference point, a category, a team membership that trumps, no pun intended, class status, because it gives us a sense of psychological superiority and even a sense of relative material well-being, where, and W.E.B. Du Bois called this the psychological wage of whiteness, that allowed even struggling white people to say, well, I might not have much, but at least I'm not black. And the problem for the class-focused left, who thinks all we got to do is like talk about class and that'll solve the problem, is that what they miss is the more effective they are. Like, you made a great point about the class disparity in the country. In my last book, Under the Affluence, I talk a lot about that, and the top 1/10 and 1/100th of 1% and all that good stuff that Occupy talked about and all the stuff Bernie talks about and all that. I agree with that analysis entirely. The problem is, the more effective I am at proving that to people, the more effective that the left is at showing, let's say, working class and lower middle class white folks how vicious the class system is, the assumption is that recognition will lead to class solidarity with black and brown folks. But the other possibility, and I think it's a greater possibility, is that if I'm that working class white guy, I hear that and I go, well, damn, that's a game I'll never win, man. Like, the revolution ain't coming. That's a lot of work. Like, they're so powerful. Screw it. I'm just going to cut a side deal over here. And when I say I'm going to cut a side deal, I'm going to forget class solidarity, man. I'm going to go over here and I'm going to hoard my resources as a white person, as a man, as a heterosexual, as a Christian. Like, I'm going to cleave to the identities where I'm winning rather than trying to get with others around an identity where we're losing. And especially in this culture where we place a high priority on winning, right? We're a culture that likes to identify with the winning team, not the losing team. So we like to identify with winners. And if I'm telling you that you're a working class person getting your ass kicked in the class system, I'm basically calling you a loser and asking you to identify on the basis of your loserness. No, thank you. Not in this country. I'm going to go over here where I'm kicking somebody else's ass. And so the reason we have to talk about race and gender and sexuality and all those things in the same breath as class is that you can't do an end run around these areas. So I think the way that we stitch together solidarity, rather than trying to say, let's use class to get solidarity, is no, let me talk to white people about how white people right now are suffering. Not just as workers, like we could make that neo-Marxist argument, and it's true. But what about how, I mean, look, we've got white folks right now who are suffering from an opioid epidemic in small town white America, not just as workers, as white people in small towns, as the people that they are suffering because for the last 40 years, we treated drugs like a crime problem and a moral problem rather than a health problem, because it was those people, black and brown, who were being locked up. And so we didn't invest in rehab and we didn't invest in treatment. And as a result, now little nephew Jimmy John over here has got a fentanyl addiction, and little Janie over here has got, you know, a heroin addiction. So we don't have to just talk about people as workers. We can talk about them as the white folks in these small towns, who they are. We can talk about the fact that there are white families right now in this COVID-19 epidemic who are burying their grandparents or burying their diabetic spouses or worried about the health of their immunosuppressed child. And the reason is because as soon as April 7th of this year, as soon as the New York Times and the Washington Post ran front page stories about how COVID was disproportionately killing black people, that very night, Tucker Carlson goes on Fox News and changes direction. He had been saying how serious this thing was until that headline. That night, he goes on television and says, well, maybe this isn't such a big deal after all. And 3 days later, Donald Trump starts talking about, we got to open everything back up again. We can't stay locked down. We got to get the economy moving. That's not a coincidence. As soon as it was shown who the disproportionate victims were, we threw caution to the wind. Well, that hasn't just affected black folks, has it? That hasn't just affected brown folks. That's killed 100,000+ white people as well. So we don't have to just talk about, oh, as a worker, you're being hurt. No, like as whoever you are, however you identify yourself, living in small town central PA, living in Nebraska, living in South Dakota, wherever the hell it is you live, as the white person you view yourself as, this is not healthy for you. And I think that approach where we talk about the interest convergence between the needs of black and brown folks and the needs of white folks, not by going to a different identity like class, but saying, no, staying right where we are, you think this is good for you. I'm showing you how it's not good for you in those white spaces that you occupy currently. And it's this, you know, uptick in white suicide, uptick in white opioid epidemic overdoses, uptick in white cirrhosis of the liver and heavy drinking, all of this stuff that's been called deaths of despair among white working class, non-college educated folks. The reason that's happening to those groups of people at a disproportionate rate is because they are the ones who were told, thanks to whiteness, that stuff would never happen, that the jobs would never disappear, that as long as they worked hard, there would be a job for them, that their kids would be better off than they were. Black folks knew that that was a myth. Brown folks knew that that was a myth. White folks were able to believe it. And because we swallowed that line, now we are ill-prepared for globalization. We are ill-prepared for the loss of jobs. We are ill-prepared for unaffordable healthcare. That was supposed to be what happened to those other people, not us. So in effect, whiteness and the expectations that come from whiteness are now responsible for killing white people. I think if we would stay right there, we don't have to dance around the issue. We can stay right there with that issue and potentially build solidarity.
Tim Wise. His book is Dispatches from the Race War. Building solidarity needs to happen not only across racial lines, but also across the rural-urban divide, as was pointed out by Jane Klebe when we talked with her about her book, Harvest the Vote. She says there's much to unite rural voters like those in her state, Nebraska, many of them white, with urban and suburban voters, many of them of color. It's something she says the Democratic Party isn't doing enough of, and she points to the 1988 presidential campaign of Jesse Jackson as an example of how it could be done, where Jackson said,
"You know, it's when the eaters and the feeders unite that we'll have real economic justice." And you hear Reverend Barber talking about these things now with the Poor People's Campaign, that yes, race matters, of course, and there's so much racial inequities happening in our country. And not but, but and white, Native American, Latino, African American, working class families share so much economic hardships, and the barriers that are in front of all of those families are the same. You know, do they have enough money to save for their kids to attend college with the increasing rates of college? You know, do they have enough money at the end of the year to take a family vacation? Can they afford quality health insurance, not just catastrophic health insurance? You know, these are the struggles that no matter if you live in a rural or an urban community, it's a bridge that the Democratic Party certainly can be talking about more. And Jesse Jackson did, Reverend Barber's doing right now, and quite frankly, Bernie Sanders did as well. It's why you saw, you know, Senator Sanders do so well in a lot of the rural states. He won Nebraska back in 2016 in the primary. He did really good in Iowa and some of these other rural states because he tied that kind of economic, true populist message, not the fake populism that Donald Trump gives, but a true populist message about looking out for our neighbors and that the government should be working for the people, not the big corporations.
Jane Klebe. Her book is Harvest the Vote. Building social solidarity is about creating a politics of empathy. That's what our guest Abdel El Sayed told us when we spoke with him in June about his book, Healing Politics. And he says we need to demand more from government. You contrast the identity politics of insecurity versus the identity politics of empathy. So what is the politics of empathy? What's the difference between the two? And why is it so important?
Yeah, a lot is made about identity politics right now. And, you know, you look at empathy, which is this big point that I talk about in the book, about the need to be able to understand why people are doing what they're doing as they suffer this epidemic of insecurity, how it affects their behavior, and how we can change it. And I believe that rather than allowing ourselves to fall into this us versus them dynamic that has corrupted so much of our politics, that we have to take the time to ask, why do you feel the way you feel and how is that animating what you do? And the thing about identities, right, is that, you know, if you think about what is empathy at a government scale, I mean, we technically call our congresspeople representative, like they represent us. And if you don't have people who represent you in the halls of power, then there's no way government can have any empathy. So I don't agree with folks who say, you know, we got to get identity out of it. There's just differences in how we live life and what we have to be paying attention to, which I talk a lot about in the book, based on who we are and where we, you know, come from in the world. And I don't mean that in terms of geographic space. I mean that in terms of experiential space. But there is also a identity politics that we cannot ignore, which is the identity politics of white supremacy. And it's the initial identity politics in American society. It's the identity politics that frames, you know, the extermination of Native Americans. It's the identity politics that frames slavery. And it's the identity politics that frames Jim Crow. It's the identity politics that frames America First. That is that identity politics of insecurity that tells us that if they take, there's less for me, that all of this is zero sum. Rather than the identity politics that I'm calling for, which is rather than buying into the same tools as that identity politics of insecurity. I believe that the identity politics of empathy ought to be about inclusion and ought to be about creating space for everyone. And it ought to reject us versus them dynamics, and it ought to embrace empathy, a willingness to dig deep and ask, who are you and what are you experiencing and how does that shape how you come to this world and what you do here? And I think if we're able to do that, it would change our politics tremendously. Now, at the same time, I get that a lot of people are frustrated, right? If you've been locked out of a political system for whatever means, you have a right to be angry and you have a right to be frustrated. I just don't know that it's effective. And so to me, right, as I think about how do we heal and how do we build, I'm looking for effective answers. And I believe that if we're able to reach across, look at someone in the eye and ask, why are you hurting and what can I do to help you? Even if the thing they think they want is not the right thing, that willingness to just step in and have heard somebody, I just think is so extremely powerful.
Yeah, and empathy politics leads to empathy policy. Lay out for us, what are some of the key components of empathy policy that can bring diverse groups together?
Yeah, I appreciate that question because I think once we recognize the way that insecurity hijacks our conversation about what we as a collective can do, we then start asking really big ideas that meet this moment. And never have we had a moment in our politics, frankly, since the Great Depression, even maybe beyond that, that we've needed to embrace big ideas. Some of the ones that I call for in the book, I write about 13 of them, and there are many others. But one of them is just to embrace the need to take on climate change and to recognize that in the work of doing that, we can provide millions of people high-quality union jobs that empower them and their families. And that's what the Green New Deal is. And the second, I believe that we need a national health insurance program that has to eliminate out-of-pocket costs, that has to cover everything, and that has to take on the power of healthcare corporations that have, you know, left us in this position where we don't have the healthcare we need when we need it. If we need it, it's going to cost us so much that it might cripple us financially. And it leaves our healthcare institutions fickle and fragile to the kinds of attacks that we saw through COVID-19. And then a last one that I'll talk about is the responsibility I think we have to rebuild our mental health infrastructure. And I think this is something that doesn't get paid as much attention to, though it ought to in the context of COVID-19, that the next epidemic that's gonna follow after this one, that's already happening, but you were just not talking about it, is the epidemic of the mental health consequences of this. And our mental health infrastructure is so woefully inadequate to the degree of burden that we had even before COVID-19 fundamentally upended so many of our lives. And so we've got to really be building there.
Abdul El Sayed. His book is Healing Politics. Finally, if we are to survive, we need not only solidarity with each other, but also with all the living beings we share the planet with. That's what Australian writer and activist Tyson Yunkaporta told us when we spoke with him about his book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. Yunkaporta told us of the many kinds of relationship pronouns Aboriginal language expresses. Us two, between two people, all the way to us all, between all people, or between people and everything else. You talk about the four principles of relating in a way that can protect the earth. And I don't know if you even use that word protect. You use a different word.
I talk about us being a custodial species.
Custodians, that's it. We're a custodial species. And so you talk about respect, connect, reflect, and direct. And so tell us about those concepts within the context of us being a custodial species, of how we need to act with each other and the earth to be able to do that.
You know, I guess these complicated systems have been developed using exactly those same four steps, but in reverse. So, you know, the hero comes into the space and directs change. This singular individual, this person who has this amazing understanding and knowledge and capacity and moral superiority and all the rest, comes into a context and tries to build order from chaos. So that's the first step, direct. And it doesn't work. It all goes wrong. You know, it just Columbuses into a big mess. And so the next step then, I guess, is reflect. So it's direct and then reflect and sitting down, head in hands, thinking what the hell went wrong. All right, we better crunch the numbers. We better check the data, try and figure out where the hell this went wrong. And that's usually at the point where people realize we probably missed a step, and that's connect. Yeah, we should have formed relationships, and we probably should have understood how things were connected across this system, all the connections and the lines of communication and energy exchange and things like that first before we came in and just started directing change, because we're kind of messed it up now. So yeah, we'll do that now. We'll start making these relationships. And then finally arriving at the point of respect. So it's kind of like, you know, oh my goodness, you know, the wisdom of this culture is amazing. You know, we're going to put a quote from that on a poster with a picture of one of the elders, and we're going to put it on the door of our toilet, because that really feeds my soul. I feel so much respect for this culture. I'm going to buy a dream catcher. That's amazing. So, you know, it goes, it's kind of like this reversal of the process. It goes, you know, direct, reflect, connect, respect. A sustainable way forward is simply to reverse that, to start with respect, because that's the work of your spirit. And then you can begin to connect, to build relationships, and that's the work of your heart. So respect, connect, and then reflect. Reflect, that's your the work of your head. And you don't do that on your own. You do that in us twos. From the relationships that you made in the former step, you do that in your us twos and in your us's, all your other us's, your exclusive groups, you know, just women, you know, or just men, or just young people, just old people, you know, just people who speak this language, etc. But then in the bigger us's, where all of those exclusive groups interact and come together, because you need that diversity. You need diverse things interacting. So what have you done? You've respected, connected, and reflected. And in reflecting, you're building the theory and the bodies of knowledge collectively that you need to move forward as custodians, as a custodial species, and to act properly in perfect ways in that place. And that leads you to the final step, which is direct. So direct is the work of your hands as you actually act on the world around you. That's when you build or make or do. And that's the correct sequence. If you come in straight away with the work of the hands and you start to build, destroy, cut down, dig up, it all goes the wrong way.
Tyson Yonkaporta. His book is Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. For our list of some other notable episodes of Writer's Voice in 2020, go to writersvoice.net. You'll find links to the full interviews we excerpted today, as well as to other interviews on that list. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.